this is Allison Sheridan of the NoCellaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, September 18th, 2011, and this is show number 330. Well, I think it's going to be a long one. We got a lot of listener contributions, a really long chit-chat across the pond with Bart, and we're going to have some fun. I'm having a lot of fun recording the live show right now. I normally record with the camera that the people in the live show see is the camera that's in my 24-inch cinema display. But as you heard last week, my 24-inch cinema display was going to be sent back to Apple. So I did get the shipping labels on Wednesday. We packed it up on Wednesday. Kyle took it over to FedEx. And they said that as soon as they got my proof that I had sent it, that they were going to be shipping the other one back. And they haven't yet. That's been 4 days. And it still says, thinking about fixing to make a plan to maybe ship you that monitor. So I'm getting a little irritated. And my little friend Chris over at Apple is not responding to me anymore as I go, dude, can I have it? I kind of need it for my show. So yesterday I tested with TechZany here, and I tested using the Bluetooth camera that I have. It's an Ecamm BT1. And everything worked perfectly yesterday, and today it will not broadcast whatsoever. Other than that, we're having trouble getting in the live chat, so business as usual. Podcasting is hard. Well, I really blew it last week. In Rod Simmons' review of the Skosh Boomcam, he told us that we'd have a giveaway for one. He got a couple of extra, and he said that we could give away one on the show. And at the end of his review, he said, and Allison will tell you how to do it. And I totally forgot about it. Completely. He reminded me, though, so that's good. So here's the deal. Here's how you can enter to win the Skosh Boomcam. I have decided to make the giveaway available to people who subscribe to the NoCellaCast News. There's a little form you fill out on the left sidebar over at podfeet.com to subscribe. So it's super easy. You put in your email address, your first name, last name, and you describe, let's see, there's three little radio buttons. Do you want HTML, text, or a mobile version of it? Hit subscribe and you're done. The other thing that's super easy is unsubscribing if you find the NoCellaCast News annoying. I'm sure you won't, but just in case. I actually hate things that let you in, but you know, like the Roach Motel won't let you back out. The current subscribers to the NoCellaCast News have already gotten the giveaway contest instructions, and many of them have already entered to win. But if you subscribe now, I'll send out another email in a few days so you get a chance to enter as well. Yes, I'm bribing you to subscribe, in case there's any doubt. To be fair, to those who listen to the show a little later than right away, I'll probably send out a couple of reminders, too, through the NoCellaCast News. The contest will run through the 30th of September, so sign up as soon as you hear this message. Now, the big advantage of subscribing to the NoCellaCast News is that if something goes wrong, let's say I get sick, my website were to get hacked, knock on wood, let's hope that doesn't happen, I win the lottery, give this all up for fame and fortune. This is one of the best ways to get notified. Okay, so there's Twitter and Facebook and Google Plus and all that, but a direct mail is so much more personal, right? Anyway, many thanks to Rod Simmons of the Simple Mobile Review podcast for pulling this giveaway together for the NoCilla Castaways. The 7th Annual Podcast Award nominations are now open. If you've got a favorite podcast and you'd like to nominate it for one of the podcast awards, head on over to podcastawards.com and choose an award category for that podcast or for a bunch of podcasts. There's 22 categories, so you can put a different one in each category. There's things like education, food and drink, GLBT, gaming, and even technology. Over 1 million people are expected to do nominations during the 15 days the nominations are open, and those nominations close on September 30th. So make haste to get over there and nominate your favorite shows. Again, it's at podcastawards.com. Well, Nightwise got a lot of flack on Twitter for his comments last week about Lion not being good for power users, and he decided that he needed to clarify his position. Now, not that he didn't enjoy the healthy debate on Twitter, and I mean, he likes a healthy debate better than just about anyone. He just couldn't resist getting back to his microphone to tell us what he thinks. Enjoy his unique style as he explains his position with Batman, a toothbrush, and a pink tutu.
Hello, NoCilla Castaways. This is Nightwise from Nightwise.com coming to you with another audio comment. As usual, recorded in the car. Since I'm mostly in the car when I'm moving from A to B, I tried horseback riding and I tried ponies. but both of them didn't really turn out, so I stick with the car. I haven't been able to get my personal Starfleet shuttle yet, but I'm working on that. So until then, it's going to be in the car. But that is not important right now. Last week, if you remember, I sent in an audio comment as well, talking about how I installed Linux Mint on my MacBook Air in order to make it go faster. Because I thought Lion was kind of slowing down my system, and I had some issues with Lion. I made a couple of comments, and those comments sparked controversy. Now, I like controversy. Controversy sparks discussion. Discussion sparks progress. So that's a good thing, isn't it? I mean, it's always a delicate, delicate game to thread into the Apple world and the Apple fans world and possibly say not very positive things about some, you know, Apple products. And yes, I did walk into the sacred pool of Appleness and probably forgot to wipe my feet because I did leave some stains and I might have sparked some discussion, and that's a good thing. Switcher Mark, Connor P, and Bart Bouchotz commented on my audio comment on Twitter about what I said, that Lion is not really a power user's operating system anymore. Now, the discussion was that Lion is not really power user friendly anymore because the power user features are hidden away in favor of simplifying the UI to make it more accessible for the general public. That was, in summary, what I meant. But that's kind of abstract, isn't it? Let's go for a real-life analogy. Real-life, day-to-day analogy that everybody can relate to. So, close your eyes and imagine you're Batman. Yes, Batman, the Dark Knight himself. Batman has a car. It is called the Batmobile. Batman also has a toothbrush, which is called the Batbrush, but it's not really a part of popular culture, so we'll skip the Batbrush. But Batman has a car, the Batmobile. And the Batmobile has some power user features that a superhero like Batman needs. I mean, let's face it. There are some stuff on there like shielding, because people do tend to shoot a lot at Batman. It goes really fast because Batman is in a hurry. I mean, he's millionaire in the day and superhero at night. He has got a pretty full schedule. And one of those fast power user features is the rocket engine. The rocket engine's in the back. It used to be in the front, but that didn't really help, so they put it in the back. It helps Batman go fast forward, because Batman doesn't really need to go fast backwards, but that's a whole other story. They also tried setting a rocket motor in the Bat Brush, but that didn't go as well either, and Batman still has sore gums from that experience. But back to the story. Rocket engine in the back helps the Batmobile go really fast. Batmobile operating system. Rocket engine power user feature. So Batman is driving around and the Joker is chasing him. And Batman goes like, ooh, I really gotta get out of here. I have no time to, you know, argue with the Joker. He's always, you know, riddling and doing stuff, and he's really weird. And he wants to come to my party, and he brings his own Joker brush, which doesn't have the same ring as the Bat Brush. So, by the way, if Batman doesn't use the Bat Brush, he has a bad breath. Ha ha! Never mind. So he needs to get out of there. So Batman grabs for the rocket engine lever. There's a lever right next to Batman's seat that says rocket engine on, and he just has to tilt that lever down. The rocket engine comes on, and the Batmobile goes really fast, like a bat out of hell. So he reaches down for the rocket engine lever, and it's not there. Now, Batman does remember that in the previous weeks, Alfred did say something, that he did some upgrades to the Batmobile to make it more user-friendly. Now, we need to elaborate what is going on here, because, you know, during the day, Batman is Bruce Wayne. You know, millionaire. He has to spend his millions and hang around with supermodels. So he can't be Batman during the day. He's Bruce Wayne during the day. And Bruce Wayne doesn't really drive around a Batmobile. He drives around in his, I don't know, Lamborghini or Bugatti Veyron, whatever is, you know, if he has a red tie, he'll use the red Ferrari and stuff like that. So the Batmobile is not used. But, you know, the Wayne family and the Wayne mansion, being a very eco-friendly environment, doesn't have all that many cars. And Alfred has been begging for a car of his own, but he just didn't get one. So Alfred needs to go grocery shopping. I mean, and he needs to get stuff, food and groceries and stuff like that, for Bruce Wayne, alias Batman, because Batman needs his bat snacks. And he goes to Walmart to do this. Now, because the Wayne Manor is a one-car household, Alfred uses the Batmobile. Bruce Wayne doesn't really like this, but, you know, Alfred has to do shopping, and you have to take a car, and when Bruce Wayne's out with the Lamborghini, Alfred's stuck with the Batmobile. Alfred doesn't really mind. The Batmobile doesn't have a very big booth, but it's okay. So Alfred hops into the Batmobile, and he goes shopping with it. Bruce Wayne is always puzzled by this because Alfred comes back with bags of groceries and pink tutus. And there's nobody in the house that wears pink tutus, at least not Bruce Wayne. So we don't know what's going on there, but that's not important right now. Now, last time when Alfred went out shopping, he went to Walmart and he had a big bag of groceries. And because the Batmobile doesn't really have a booth, he puts them inside, you know, the cabin, the main cabin. So Alfred's, you know, lugging around two big bags of groceries, and he just throws them into the main cabin. And he accidentally hits the rocket power switch that is in between the seats. Now, the rocket power switch tilts down, and the rocket engine activates, only for a brief while. But the Walmart greeter that was in the direct path of the exhaust flame didn't really appreciate it. So Alfred thought, oh, this is a very power user feature of the Batmobile, and I am just an ordinary mortal, and I accidentally use it. This is dangerous. Let's put it away. So, back, flash forward to the present, Batman being chased by the Joker, reaching for the lever. Lever is not there. There's a little note that says, please check glove compartment for rocket-powered engine, for rocket-powered lever. So, Batman sighs, opens up the glove compartment. There's a little note that says, please, dear Batman, we have moved the rocket power lever in order to make the Batmobile more user-friendly for mortal people and not accidentally tripping power user features. So please yodel the swish recipe for cheese backwards to activate the rocket power. Batman sighs again, Joker getting closer, and he goes, yodel, yodel, yodel. Doesn't work the first time. Yodel, yodel, yodel. Doesn't work the second time. Yodel, yodel. Boom, it works. Rocket engine activates. Bam! Batmobile, out of here. Joker, not really happy. And that's about the same analogy that I have with Lion. I know it might not be something that all of us might experience in a day-to-day basis, but, you know, most of you can relate to being Batman and the Joker and Alfred and the millionaire and the Bugatti Veyron and the groceries. And some of you might relate to pink tutus, which is very disturbing. No matter, that's not important right now. My point with Lion is that Lion is the Batmobile. It is very powerful, and it is very cool, and it is also very heavy and quite fat, but that's not important right now. And the power user features are indeed still there, but they are not in plain sight anymore. They are in the glove compartment, and you can reach for them. And if you're a superhero and you know they're in the glove compartment, and you know how to yodel the recipe for Swiss cheese backwards three times, that's all good. I mean, if you get very good at it, that's just fantastic. But, I mean, who are we? It depends on who we are. Are we the regular mortal? Are we just Alfred going shopping with the Batmobile? Then having the rocket switch in the glove compartment is actually safe and a good thing. And if you're Batman and you can reach the glove compartment and you can yodel the recipe for Swiss cheese, that's a good thing. But is Lion then really a Batmobile? Is it really made for superheroes? I don't know. Or is it just a regular car with extra features? That is my question, and that was my point. I think that Lion is the Batmobile. It is cool. It is fast. if you don't put it on a MacBook Air, and it has a rocket engine somewhere. But in order to reach it, we need to yodel the recipe for Swiss cheese. And if you're a superhero that's good at that, that's okay. Dandelion's the perfect Batmobile for you. If you're just a regular mortal that has a little bit of trouble with all these power user features, then Lion is fantastic. It's the perfect operating system for you. But if the Joker is chasing you, and you are a superhero, and you need to get out of there in a pinch and access those power user features at a snap, just at the reach of your fingertips, Lion might not be that ideal. And that was my argument. Meanwhile, I have entertained you with Batman, bad jokes, the Joker, Alfred, pink tutus, and Swiss cheese. All of that and more in the Nocilla cast. For more rantings and actually stuff that makes sense, head over to nightwise.com and catch more of this. See you guys next week.
Well, you know, I never know how to do the outro for Nightwise because he just says it all, and he says it in his own unique way, as we said. So I'll just leave it as that. Well, next up, George from Tulsa has some opinions on Nightwise crazy ideas, so I figured it'd be a good spot to enter him right now. Let's hear his position on this topic.
Love Lion or jumped ship with Nightwise, who told us in show 328 how he wiped Lion from his air and replaced it with Linux Mint. Listen to Mac Geek Gab, which has lately been filled with anguished reports of some pretty serious Lion problems? As to Nightwise, I do have to wonder, what was he thinking? Many of Lion's new features try to make systems work like iOS, which depends on 100% solid-state memory. Versioning, state saving, and boot app relaunch have to be written, then read from disk. Works in iOS and its 100% solid-state memory, not so much on the original Air's minimal system RAM and 4200 RPM let's-go-watch-paint-dry hard drive. Lion sunk its claws into my wallet only because I couldn't resist the new i5 Air and its much less glossy screen. Yes, it geek benches more than twice as fast as my 11-inch Core 2. But in my real world, real life, Lion system friction erases the new computer's speed advantages. Since it isn't possible to install Snow Leopard on my new Air, I've been working to reverse as many of Lion's deprovements as I can. On first start, I went straight to System Preferences and restored both normal scrolling and scroll bars. If I wanted an iPad, I wouldn't have given mine away. Washing out Lion's dirty linen took longer, and sadly, I haven't killed it all. I used Deeper app to clean Lion's linen from my logon screen. Thanks to Deeper, my logon screen is now a lovely photo onto which I added my name and phone number in big, clear text, just in case some honest person finds my lost Air and wants to return it. There's lots more tweaks in Deeper, which is also available in versions for Snow Leopard back through Tiger. In many ways similar to Deeper, Tinker Tools has been updated for Lion and provides access to otherwise hidden system settings. Then there's Lion Tweaks app, written by a 16-year-old Norwegian and downloaded by the tens of thousands. Every day brings more ways to make Lion less Lion-esque. Now if someone would just bring back Quicken, Snow Leopard's speed, and please, oh please, file save as. If Lion frustrates you, check the ongoing Lion tips and tweaks reports running in Lifehacker, Cult of Mac, and OS X Daily. They frequently tell of new ways to take your Mac back. as always, links to everything in the show notes.
Hey, George, thanks for all of this. This is fantastic. I actually used some of the stuff you put in there, messing around with my Lion logon screen. Pretty cool stuff. I've enjoyed making some changes there. That was very cool. Thanks a lot. Well, I was listening to MacBreak Weekly this weekend with good friend Don McAllister from Screencast Online on the show. He was great as always, of course. I got really excited when he did his pick of the week, though, because he picked Screen Steps. Now, Don is the master of documentation, but he normally works in video form. But like all of us, he has to create written documentation to others from time to time as well. He described how he could do quick screen captures, much like you can with Sketch, but that the tool that's built into Screen Steps is so easy he can annotate the images while plopping them right down next to his documentation. He went on to explain that he can then put the text explaining each step, easily export to PDF, HTML, or even upload to their paid service for Screen Steps live hosting. That's if you really, really get into doing this and want to have a professional site hosted by them. He described how if you get the pro version for $80, you can export full manuals in such a way as well. If you don't need that much horsepower, the $40 standard version lets you export to your own blog if you use WordPress, MovableType, TypePad, Squarespace, Blogger, Joomla, or Drupal. That's pretty much all of the good ones, right? Well, if you don't believe me after this all this time, for sure you trust Don's advice, right? You can go over and get a free trial of Screen Steps from BlueMangoLearning.com or ScreenSteps.com. But be sure to tell them that you heard about it from me, not Don. Even if it does have the adorable British accent. Rhett Simmons of the Simple Mobile Review podcast is back with a review of the Motion GPS Drive for iOS.
Hi, guys. This is Rod Simmons from Simple Mobile Review. This week, I'd like to review a product called Motion X GPS. But first, what's the problem we're solving? Well, you bought the iPhone. And not that it's a bad phone, it's actually probably the best phone on the market. The reality is, the Maps application, while innovative for its time, is a bit long in the tooth, and it doesn't really compete with the likes of Android's built-in GPS solution. The problem is, you don't want to switch platforms to Android, because you have a lot of dedicated apps for iOS, and you don't feel like rebuying. But you also don't need the cost, you don't want to spend the money for Garmin or Navigon or TomTom. I mean, at $60 or $70 for those apps, they're a bit expensive. You don't need GPS on a day-to-day basis, and if you're going to use GPS, you want a relatively inexpensive solution. And that's where Motion X comes in. So Motion X GPS Drive costs you 99 cents for 30 days of turn-by-turn navigation. So when you go to the App Store, it's 99 cents to buy the app. You get 30 days of live turn-by-turn navigation with voice guidance. Now, after that 30 days is over, you have an in-app purchase you can do for another $2.99 and get navigation for another 30 days, or you can pay $19.99 and get navigation for a year. Now, if you're like most people, you probably don't need navigation on a day-to-day basis. You probably need it when you're taking that trip to Aspen, Colorado, where you probably have gone once or twice and you need help getting around, or when you're on your summer vacation and you're trying to get around and find restaurants and stuff like that. You want a really good turn-by-turn solution that can get you around where you want to go. But during the rest of the year when you're at home, you pretty much drive however you need, and you don't worry about using a GPS solution. So that's where the pricing model for Motion X GPS Drive fits in. Now, I'm pretty sure what you're thinking. For 99 cents or for $2.99, you're probably getting an inferior product. And that's absolutely not the case. All the key things that you'd want out of a GPS solution are built inside of Motion X. So you get the massive turn-by-turn navigation screen you would expect with, you know, the visual as well as voice prompts that you have an upcoming turn. You get the driving list of what your physical driving directions are so you can kind of get an idea. You get kind of a heads-up display that lets you know your next turn is about half a mile away or 0.7 miles away or 2 miles away. You're also remember getting real-time, up-to-date maps. So rather than having to buy a map system today and then update the maps later on, your maps are constantly going to be updated. You also get live traffic reports. So if there's traffic incidents going on, you actually get information about traffic so to help you understand what's going on, and also trying to give you a better route around traffic. So all the core things that you want in a GPS solution is actually built into Motion X GPS Drive. Additionally, which are probably some really good features that everybody wants, is the kind of quick check buttons you want in a GPS solution, like as in, I'm here in South Beach and I'm looking for a good restaurant. Hit the restaurants button and it'll give you all the restaurants around you. Then you can kind of filter that down by the cuisine type you want. In a city you're not familiar with and looking for parking, hit the park button and it'll actually find public parking things that are sort of nearby you so you can quickly navigate to parking. There's also, for me, which is probably near and dear to my heart, always looking for an airport or a gas station, fill up my rental car, and then get back to the airport. So those types of things are just built in. They're really quick tap buttons on a very gorgeous heads-up display that's kind of like a the navigation interface for this reminds me of the BMW's iDrive navigation or BMW iDrive interface that they have now for their cars. So it's quick and easy for you to toggle, get yourself around the app, and most importantly, get your turn-by-turn directions. Simple solution to use, very easy, and tremendously inexpensive. So if you're not in for paying, you know, $60 or $70 for something like a TomTom, Navigon, or a Garmin solution, I would consider Motion X GPS Drive.
Hey, Rod, this sounds fantastic. Jenna Duffy from the live chat just said that she uses the software too. She uses Motion X GPS, and she loves it too. I can think of a perfect use for this app. Steve and I both have cars with built-in GPS units, so we don't actually need Motion X GPS day-to-day. However, when we do travel for work, which is fairly frequently, one or the other of us is traveling, we drag a Garmin GPS unit along with the mount and the charging cable and all that nonsense. We always have our iPhones with us, so for, you know, $2 a month when we're using it, as a service fee, that's chump change for the couple of times a year we would really need it. So that might work. I guess we'd have to get some sort of mount, like you say, though. I'm not quite sure how we'd do that. Thanks for the review. That was excellent. Well, I've converted over to Lion, even though a few of my applications aren't completely functional yet. One of those applications is Wiretap Studio from Ambrosia Software. Wiretap Studio is designed to allow you to create a recording of two different sources and keep them as separate tracks during editing and then do non-destructive editing when you're done. The problem in Lion is that it won't let you record a specific application, like, say, Skype. You have to choose Mac Audio, which means it records all sounds coming out of your mic, out of your computer, including Skype. This works okay for me. I record Mac Audio on one channel and my microphone on the other. The only problem is that I have to make sure that any applications that could possibly make noise during the recording are shut off. That means no checking Twitter or email or AIM when I'm supposed to be paying attention to an interview. Why am I telling you all of this? Well, because it wasn't until I was using Wiretap Studio and Lion that I realized how much I actually do use Text Expander. I can't type hardly anything while I'm supposed to be paying attention. Even with all the social networking stuff closed, I might sneak open, I don't know, like Google Plus while somebody's talking, you know, get a little bit of entertainment. But let me explain what happens. Every time I type, and I have to use Text Expander because I'm not going to type out all those words all the time. I have Text Expander snippets for everything. So every time I type Text Expander, it makes that little bloop noise. So I hope nobody notices on occasion, maybe during some of my interviews, that every once in a while you'll hear that little noise. That means I'm misbehaving, actually. I just realized while I was doing this, I was typing this up, this tiny little paragraph that I just wrote for this part of the ad, I've expanded WTS semicolon to be Wiretap Studio four times, TE semicolon to do Text Expander twice, GP semicolon to give me Google Plus twice. I realized I use Text Expander constantly while I'm typing. It's just second nature to me now. It's like typing the real words to use the snippets. Let's check my stats. We haven't looked in on those in a while. Since January, I've expanded 7,763 snippets, saving me over 11 hours of typing. Now, come on, they have a free trial over at smilesoftware.com. By the way, that was a snippet, including all the wrapped around HTML for that. And when you're ready to buy, it's only $34.95. If you're really lazy, you can just click on the big smile icon in the left sidebar over on podfeet.com. Be sure to tell them you heard about it on the NoSillaCast, okay? NoSillaCast is a snippet too. So is Nocilla Castaways. They're everywhere. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond. And this week it is with the original Chit Chat Across the Pond. It is with Bart Bouchatz. How are we today, Bart?
Not too bad. A little drained from a day of cleaning, but it's nice to be in a clean house.
Ooh, that is nice. I like it better when somebody else does it, but what the heck?
Yeah, my house elf has gone missing. I don't know where he is.
Well, don't give him a sock or anything, whatever you do. All right, well, why don't we kick right in? We have Security Light. What's been happening this week?
Sort of the two usuals this week. So we start with Microsoft on Patch Tuesday. There are 5 updates, which rated important, which is not as high as critical, but it's still pretty high. Mm. And only 5, so by Microsoft standards, it's a weeny-teeny one.
It's a good week.
Yeah, now they've managed to spread them out quite well, so they're in all versions of Windows and all versions of Office, including Office for the Mac. So they're well spread out, but there's only 5 of them.
Oh, yeah, I did get a thing from CNET telling me that my version of Office 2004 that I'm not running is needed an update.
Yeah, 2004, 2008, and 2011 for the Mac all got updates.
Nice. I don't think I checked it on the other one. I should do that.
Yeah, and I don't remember all the Windows versions of Office that got updates, but I think it's fair to say them all. And in terms of the versions of Windows, it covers everything from Windows XP through Vista through 7 through Server 2008.
Nice. Now, was this the set of patches that accidentally got released early?
I didn't hear of any such thing.
Oh yeah, it was a real bad thing. The release of what was going to be in the patch came out like 2 or 3 days before Patch Tuesday. That's not what you want to see, because it's like, hey, here, red flag, exploit this here.
Here, bad guys manual on how to. Yeah, that's a whoopsie. That's certainly not supposed to happen.
Not quite what they were looking for.
No. And they're usually very good about that. They have very good procedures, so that usually doesn't happen.
Yeah, it was supposed
to be Microsoft.
Fairly unusual.
Yeah.
Anything else?
Well, I said both of are normal, so that means obviously the A letter one is also involved. So Adobe, continuing with their new tradition of writing Microsoft's coattails, also released on Patch Tuesday. In their case, it's critical updates, not important, but critical to Adobe Acrobat and Adobe Reader for all platforms, so Windows, Unix, and Mac. So either get them off your system or update them. Take your pick.
Now, Adobe got a little stake in the heart this week with Microsoft saying that they're not going to include plugins in Windows 8, I think. They said they're not going to include Flash as a default.
Good. Well, Apple have shown you can get away with it and become the most popular makers of tablets on the planet. So this old idea that everyone is hostage of Adobe has been, that illusion has been shattered by Apple. And I think Microsoft are more than happy. You know, Microsoft have enough security problems of their own. They really don't need to take on Adobe's as well.
Exactly. I kind of like the things that they're, in a lot of cases, taking from Apple's lead, but then in a lot of cases, improving on what Apple has done. Not to get off on too much of a Windows 8 thing, but I was really pleased to see they did. I saw a demo during the Build conference of how you submit an application for inclusion in the store for Windows 8. And one of the things you get to choose from is, would you like to offer a demo version? Why, yes, I would. How long would you like that demo version to last? 7 days, 30 days, you get to pick.
Yeah.
And say, yeah, come on, Apple, that would be great. That would be so much better that way. They also
it would. And the other thing I like that they've taken is, now, I may be wrong, but I think I'm right, that a lot of the development stuff for Windows Phone 7 is HTML5, seems to be the way to get apps on there.
Right, right.
Which, again, nice open platform, Adobe-free, very much taking Apple's lead there.
Yeah, definitely. One of the other improvements they did was when a developer submits an application to be included in the store for Windows 8, it'll actually show them the steps that the application is going through and how far through the process it is. So it's not just this black hole you dump your app into and wondering, when is it going to come out? I don't know. It could be, a day from now, a month from now, never. And one of the steps was a technical tool where it tests your product, and they actually give you that tool so you can run it on your own product before you submit it to the store, so you know that it's going to pass, or you can see what kinds of things does it have to pass.
Yeah, I think Apple have improved their procedure on that end too, because I think you see a state now as well.
If you
submit through the
app. Oh, that's good.
Apple have been slowly iterating their process, so it's not as it was on day one, which was very primitive.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it has been improving, so, that's also good.
That's good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, back on topic. So we're done with Security Light. What's our main topic this week?
Our main topic is, I guess, our other security story, which is, in many regards, a follow-on and then delving a little deeper into an issue we talked about last time, which was just breaking at the time, where there was a stray cert issued for Google by DigiNotar. And I remember saying that like this was probably the tip of the iceberg and there was probably more to come on this story. And, oh goodness me, yes, was there ever more to come on this story.
Well, in case people don't remember, can you give us a brief synopsis of what that was?
So an SSL certificate issued for star.google.com was found that was not issued to Google. So it was a cert that was signed by DigiNotar that was in the hands of other people, which allowed them to impersonate any Google service. And it was in particular, it was found to be in use in Iran, basically for spying on political activists, which is not good. And, you know, that was a big deal that cert had gotten out and that DigiNotar had clearly been in some way compromised. But the feeling among the community was that the other shoe had yet to drop and that there was more to come. And that certainly turned out to be true. It wasn't one cert. It was hundreds of certs. And not just, you know, certs for big names, but also certs like star.star.com and star.star.org.
That would be sort of like everything?
www.anything.com, yeah.
Jeez.
You know, so these are, yeah.
And this was all the hack on, we're still talking about DigiNotar at this point.
We're still talking about DigiNotar at this point, so that's what was revealed. Now, what was also revealed was that this didn't happen recently. This happened a few months back in the middle of the summer.
Oh.
And DigiNotar knew about it and kept their mouth shut.
Okay, they have to go out of business now, right?
I think that seems immensely likely. Everyone is very, very unimpressed. It's one thing to be hacked. It can happen to anyone. It happened to Komodo about a half a year ago, I think it was. And there were 9 fraudulent certs issued out of Komodo. But Komodo were open and honest about it. And it was, you know, browsers were patched with the 9 certs added to be ignored. And it was a little disconcerting, but it wasn't very worrying because, you know, Komodo were open and honest about it, and it wasn't such a big deal. It was dealt with very quickly. So, you know, the actual window of risk to people was small.
So Komodo's certs did not have to be removed from all the browsers and stuff like we had to in DigiNotar?
Well, what they did in the Komodo case was, because it was only 9 certs, those 9 certs were removed rather than the root certificate being removed.
Okay. All right. So they get to stay in business, maybe.
Oh, no, absolutely. They do. They're still in business. They're still a major...
They did their job responsibly.
Precisely.
Okay.
Whereas DigiNotar were utterly, utterly irresponsible. So they kept their trap shut, but they did silently issue, add the certs to their revocation list, which we'll talk about later, which is how they eventually got noticed.
Hmm.
Because Google Chrome checked the revocation list, was handed the cert, and went, whoa, this is not a valid cert. And then it came to people's attention, wait a second, Google Chrome just told me this cert for google.com is not valid. What's going on here? And then people looked more closely and went, well, hang on a sec. Google are a certificate authority. They sign their own certs. Why is this Google cert signed by these Dutch people?
Oh.
And that's how the story broke.
Oh, because they didn't have a cert for it. They didn't have the real cert. They only had the hacked version?
Yeah, so they were browsing and they were presented with the hacked version. So I believe they were in Iran, so they were going through the government firewall, and the government firewall was probably what was serving them the fake cert so they could do a man-in-the-middle attack and listen in on what they were saying.
Mm-hmm.
So because they were using Google Chrome, when the fake cert was presented to the browser, Google Chrome went, whoa.
Because Google Chrome knows that Google issues its own cert.
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
So Google Chrome went, no. And that's how it came to light. But that came to light a couple of weeks after the revocation, which came to light a couple of weeks after the hack.
So explain revocation.
A lot of weeks we're going to talk about revocation later, but
okay.
Basically...
You keep teasing it.
I do, because we have a few more things to get through.
Okay, I'll be patient.
So they didn't disclose responsibly at all. There are hundreds of certs. What's also happened since is that the hacker responsible has released a statement saying that he... First of all, he issued proof, which is very important. So he was able to issue proof because he... basically had DigiNotar's root certificate and was able to hand over an executable file that he had written signed with DigiNotar's root certificate, which proves he had access to DigiNotar's signing infrastructure.
Okay.
So The hacker, after proving that he was who he said he was the same guy who also hacked Komodo, and says he also hacked four other top-tier certificate authorities. He said he wasn't going to name them all, but he was going to name one, and the one he named was GlobalSign, which is one of the largest in the world.
Okay.
GlobalSign, on hearing this, immediately, preemptively stopped issuing certificates. They simply pulled the plug.
Good on them.
Very good on them. They acted immensely responsibly. So their first step was instantly chop, stop issuing certs. Then they called in the computer forensics people who were investigating DigiNotar hack. And since they would recognize the same signs, they called those people in to do a full audit inside GlobalSign. Again, very responsible thing to do. And they found that, yes, some of GlobalSign's web servers were compromised, but no fraudulent certificates had been issued.
Oh. So he claimed he did, but he didn't.
No, he was in. He said he was in, and he was in. He just hadn't
gotten around to doing it yet.
Yeah, so he was in. He just hadn't abused his access yet.
Okay.
So he was basically like a sleeper cell, you should look at it as.
Okay.
So GlobalSign eradicated the breach, and they've also shared the details of how the hacks were done with other certificate authorities.
Okay.
They haven't shared that with the world, but they have shared it with other certificate authorities, so they can go in and check themselves and make sure that they're okay. So GlobalSign is an example of what you should do. DigiNotar, an example of what you shouldn't.
But
in terms of other practical
What about all the other eight that he says, or no, was it nine
He didn't list names.
Okay.
He said he had more.
One would hope the other ones are checking.
He could just be bragging. I mean, if you read his posts, they are immensely self-aggrandizing.
But at the same time, he hasn't been shown to be lying yet.
No, so far he is most certainly a very skilled attacker, but you know, you should hear him talk. It's quite funny. In fact, if you are interested, there's amazingly good coverage of all of this stuff on Security Now, including a lot of discussion on the statements and stuff, and Leo reading them out in a terrible Iranian accent and so forth.
Good.
But if you're interested, there's really good coverage there. So, practicalities. When last we spoke, Firefox had issued 6.0.1 and 3.6.21, which did a sort of a surgical stripping of the known bad cert. It didn't entirely kill DigiNotar Trust. It was much more surgical strike than that.
Yeah.
Firefox have now said, oh, no. As soon as it became to light that these people knew and kept quiet, Firefox issued 6.0.2 and 3.6.22, which fully strips out all DigiNotar Trust of any sort. And Firefox were very clear about the matter. This is not a temporary suspension. Which gets back to your point of going out of business. DigiNotar are probably never going to be added back into Firefox's trust, which means that DigiNotar cannot issue certs to people because no one wants a cert that won't work in 1/5 of browsers on the planet.
Right, exactly. Good.
Yeah, so that's good. Apple also sprung to life eventually. Better late.
Sprung? Creakily got out of their rocking chair, you mean?
Yeah, I put in the show notes, lurched into action.
Lurched.
It certainly wasn't
It was about a week and a half after we talked, or a week after we talked.
Yeah, they were late. They were just plain old late to the party. So they released Security Update 2011-005 for Snow Leopard and Lion. Teeny tiny little update, because all it has to do is strip out a cert. So it's like 118K, I think, on some platforms, and I think it might be as much as 18 megabytes in some places. But, I mean, as updates go, it's teeny tiny. Something to note, this update is for Snow Leopard and Lion. What's missing from that list?
Leopard.
I can now officially declare the Leopard dead. If Apple are not issuing you with security patches, it is time to move. If you are using Leopard, you are at risk. Serious risk, and that risk is going to get bigger every single day that passes.
That's Leopard. That's 10. If you're using Safari. If you were using Firefox, you'd be okay?
For this particular issue? But
right,
Apple has stopped issuing security updates.
Yeah.
So everything else that gets patched in OS X from here on forward, you're left out of. So yeah, you can do a workaround for this one. But you can't keep doing workarounds forever.
Right. Well, I got my in-laws to buy Snow Leopard, and I'm going to upgrade them next time I'm down there. So,
you're not going to Lion with them?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I will mention it. I will explain it, but they're kind of like, no, we're fine. And they have Office 2004, and they're happy with it. And the machines are about 3 or 4 years old now, and they're just plodding along happy. So.
Okay. Well, I found a lot of the more user-friendly features in Lion went down very well with family.
Hmm. Those resistant to change?
Okay, maybe the resistance to change is a different issue, yes.
By the way...
Maybe a little demo on your laptop might encourage them.
Maybe.
Maybe. Anyway, yeah, they need to get off 5. That's all that matters. 6,
by the way, Firefox did not update for me. Did not automatically update. I just checked it at 6.01. So I just pressed a button that said apply update, and now it's doing it. But it didn't automatically do it, oddly enough.
Well, has it popped up and you told it to wait till later?
Mm-mm. No. I never say wait till later to Firefox.
I always say wait till later to Firefox, because I have a million tabs open. So I do it last thing at night and just say, okay, now that I don't need you anymore for a couple of hours, you can spend an hour closing yourself down. And
but then I just did the update, and now it says, hey, guess what? Your Flash player is out of date.
Well, that's also good to know.
But that means I got to do this. Okay, fine.
Anywho, sorry. I'm distracting you in the middle of recording. So... basically, the leopard is dead. So move to Snow Leopard if you don't like change, or Lion if you do. The other thing to note is what has not been patched is iOS. So all of our iDevices are still at risk.
Whoa. To these now. They do that cert thing too, don't they?
Yeah. Anything. Yeah. So secure email, secure web browsing, VPN connections. None of it's trustworthy on the iOS now. And this is, to me, this is a big deal, and I think it's disgraceful that Apple are waiting so long. Now, we know that iOS 5 is just around the corner. They're on, like, beta 8 or 9 at this stage. I've lost count. So the chances are that very shortly we will see iOS 5 and it will fix the problem. But nonetheless, this has been 2 weeks and counting now, and obviously someone in Apple has made the decision that it's okay, but it's not a decision I agree with.
Yeah. Well, one of the good things about iOS 5 is going to be the over-the-air updates. Because I talk to people all the time that say, oh, I never plug my phone in.
It's not just the never plugging it in. The over-the-air bit of the updates is definitely a good thing in iOS 5. But there's actually a much more important good thing. It's that the updates are Delta updates. Up until this point in iOS's existence... If Apple want to change one uppercase letter to a lowercase letter, they have to give you the entire operating system again.
And that's a file that sits on your computer. I think I have 1.5 gigs worth of those little IPA files.
Yeah. Well, the IPAs are your apps.
Okay, the other one.
Those disk images stay on your, and it's not even the same one. So you have an iPhone, you plug it in and it downloads it all. Mm-hmm. And you plug in your iPad and it goes, ooh, I think I'll go get you another version of iOS because you'd like two copies, wouldn't you?
Yeah, and then I get the iPad and just...
Exactly. So all of that's going away with iOS 5. So hopefully iOS 5 will enable Apple to get their finger out a little quicker in future.
Yeah, yeah. And people to actually do it. I mean, the friends of mine that don't update or don't plug it in, they never get, even if Apple were just lickety-split on it, they would never get the updates anyway.
True, but I'm more worried about the fact that people who are security conscious can't update.
Well, true.
So either way, for both problems, iOS 5 is a ray of sunshine, which will make it much easier for Apple to respond quickly. So if ever you wondered why it's important that iOS 5 come out, this is a good example.
Yeah, yeah.
So I guess what I wanted to then sort of move into was the bigger picture in all of this. This really forces us to look again at the sort of the implications of this for... the product of technologies known as SSL and TLS, which is Secure Socket Layer and Transport Layer Security. And pretty much anything that we do online that's secure, if you scratch away the surface, you'll find it's SSL TLS. So HTTPS is HTTP over TLS.
What?
So that little... HTTPS.
That yeah.
So HTTPS is the HTTP protocol over TLS.
Not over SSL.
What's TLS? The old name for TLS.
Oh,
SSL is technically not correct to say anymore.
I did not know that.
So SSL is your socket layer.
Okay.
And TLS is transport layer security.
Okay.
No. But TLS is the more... People just say both. Did you say SSL/TLS because it's just easier and you're okay. bound to hit the right acronym if you throw both of them out?
Okay. All right.
It's technically TLS that's being used. So when you see that little lock icon in your browser, at the core is SSL TLS. Okay. When you connect to your email securely, it's IMAP over SSL or TLS.
Oh, okay. I'm getting it.
So pretty much every secure anything you do is whatever it would be insecurely over TLS.
Wait, insecurely? I thought we were secure because of the...
To make things secure, our approach has been keep doing things with the old protocol, but just wrap that old protocol in TLS.
Oh, okay. All right.
So IMAP is an insecure protocol, but if you do IMAP over TLS, then TLS gives you the security, so it's all good. And that's how we've secured so many things, is we just wrap them in a bit of TLS, and then we're fine.
Okay.
But all of this depends on the certificate authorities. So if you think, basically, the way to think about this, which scares people, but it's true, all of the fundamentals of the internet from the lowest level, from the physical Ethernet level, right up to TCP and DNS, are all fundamentally insecure by design.
Because...
And by that I mean that security was not considered as a design constraint, and therefore it was simply not implemented. So they're insecure because no one thought to think about security.
Okay, and that's why we have to wrap them in SSL/TLS.
So we rely, exactly, we rely on SSL TLS to add a layer of security on top of a completely insecure foundation that goes all the way down to the fundamentals of networking. So TLS has been our answer to the fact that the internet was designed with security just not even thought about. So we know that the DNS system is rickety and broken and very insecure. We don't care because we use HTTPS to verify that we really are at our bank and that we haven't been sent to some bad guy.
As long as there's nothing wrong with SSL, that's a good idea.
Exactly. So if we assume that all the certificate authorities are trustworthy, then SSL gives us confidentiality, which means that no one can eavesdrop on our conversations. It gives us integrity, which means that no one can inject information into the conversation. So what was sent is what's received.
The inject is the man in the middle attack?
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. So, I mean, something that a bad guy could do could be, say, if you were banking, they were in the middle, they could suck out your actual details and return to you you mistyped your password display, while at the same time they go off and steal all your money.
Okay.
So integrity is important. So confidentiality, integrity, and authenticity. If you see that lock icon and you are on PayPal.com, you can be confident that you're on PayPal.com. So you are talking to who you think you're talking to. So confidentiality, integrity, and authenticity. All the three things we need to be able to do anything securely online. We need to know that we're talking to who we think we're talking to, otherwise we could be giving our deepest secrets to bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
We need to know that what we send is what arrives and what we get is what was sent. And we need to know that no one's listening. And all those three things we get through SSL and TLS. And the entirety of that architecture hangs on the assumption that certificate authorities are secure and trustworthy. Everything is built off that assumption. If you pull out that assumption, the whole thing collapses.
Like now.
Like now. Mm. Now, it's not entirely as horrific as we think, because the people who designed SSL were not stupid. So they were actually thinking ahead a little. So there are protocols built into the system to deal with issues with certificates. So it's not quite as bad as it could be.
Is there going to be a happy ending in this anywhere? Like, just give us hope a little bit. Are you going to tell us what we do about this?
Yeah. No. Okay. We're coming to practical things.
Okay, good. No, it's not that you're being impractical. It's just I don't want to know if I can't do something about it. Right?
No, it's not one of those things where you're doomed and that's that.
Okay.
We're not heading into a black hole.
Okay, good.
But just to emphasize the importance of certificate authorities, they are pivotal in all of our internet security.
Right.
So we've definitely known for a while, as with the Komodo hack, what really drove that home, that CAs are not perfect about their security because, let's face it, there's no such thing as perfect security. That's just not possible. So we've known that for a while, and that doesn't really faze us too much. What we haven't had before is bad actors in the game, because we have always been able to assume that our certificate authorities actually are honest.
But incompetent.
Yeah. Honest, but they, you know, not necessarily incompetent, but...
No, I said and competent.
Yeah.
Right.
But even if even the best people get breached sometimes, that's just reality. You don't have to be Sony to get breached.
Right.
But if Sony, it happens. So, you know, the DigiNote, I think, sort of chips away at another part of this. So, fundamentally, you could say that the three problems are that there's way too many certificate authorities so that you can properly supervise them. If you look in your browser, there's hundreds of them.
Oh, really?
Very hard to supervise hundreds of companies.
Sure.
There isn't really much oversight of their security practices. So some of them may work very hard, like GlobalSign. Some of them may not work so hard. Very little oversight going on, so you can't really tell. And there's also not enough oversight. So in order to get into a browser, every browser company has a list of rules that a certificate authority has to follow. So there are rules Mozilla put out, there are rules IE put out, there are rules Chrome put out, and if you don't meet those rules, you don't get included in the browser. But there's no real policing of those rules.
What do you mean by policing of the rules? You mean to see if they are really following them?
Yeah. So one of the conditions is that you have to report breaches. Well, DigiNote clearly weren't following that. We didn't find out about it because DigiNote told anyone. So, yes, they've all agreed to these rules, but, you know, we all click yes, I agree on things on the internet and just completely ignore what it said. Well, that's sort of how the CAs are behaving.
Or so one is.
Well, the problem is any one is enough. Any one, sure. One bad CA is enough to compromise every single site on the internet.
But we don't know that anybody else has been stupid other than DigiNotar. Exactly.
Yeah,
they
we don't.
May exactly. have been, but we don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So there's certainly lots of room for the browser companies to step up and to become much stricter about who they let into the browser. And I think, you know, Firefox, I think, is seeing the light there. They seem quite clear about the fact that they're not happy with DigiNotar. So I think you'll find that it's no longer as easy to become a CA, because I think everyone's had a wake-up call here. And I think you'll see the browser companies taking steps to, you know, maybe random inspections. I don't know what they're going to choose to do, but I imagine we'll see a response from the browser companies. So there's organizational stuff to do. Then you also have third parties who are not either the browsers or the CAs, who are just interested in the safety of people online, who are sort of stepping back and trying to measure the problem. See how much of this is going on.
Oh, really?
And, you know, so there's a thing called the SSL Observatory, and I'm convinced it's run by the EFF, and now that I see it in the show notes, I remember I didn't actually double-check that, but I think it is. It's the kind of thing they would do. And the idea of the SSL Observatory is that they simply monitor the internet and they look at the pairings of certificate to domain that fly around on the internet. And they just log them all. This certificate, this domain, this certificate, this domain, this certificate, this domain. And as fake certificates fly around, you will see that, you know, we have 5 million times that Google.com was served from this certificate and then 4 times was served from this certificate. Well, this is a fraudulent certificate. But that information is stored and searchable, and therefore you can go back, and whenever something happens, you can go and see how big of a problem was this. And you can run all sorts of analysis on that massive pool of data to really understand what's happening. So we will know whether or not tighter controls on CAs is achieving its goal, because the SSL Observatory will give us the hard data.
I just verified it is the EFF.
Phew, I thought it would be them. They're very good at those kind of things. So we will know if our attempts to improve things are working, because the SSL Observatory will be watching.
I love facts and data.
Facts and data are good. So I really like the fact that the EFF are getting involved with this. And it should help keep everyone straight on the straight and narrow. And it should help us to find who are the most untrustworthy CAs, who are the most trustworthy CAs, which are the best browsers and so forth.
Hmm.
So this is good. Data's good. So there's a role for the browser manufacturers. There's a role for the EFF. What about us? We'd like to do something ourselves.
Sure.
So I guess the first thing you could say is, if you were to take all technology out of it and you were to just watch what's happening, I'm not going to go down that train yet, sorry. I said I wrote this into a narrative and then I just went off script. So I had mentioned that the people who designed SSL were thinking ahead. And so the possibility of bad certs has been defined into the system from the start. Not so much bad CAs, that's not really something that was thought of, but bad certificates most certainly was thought of. So there's a provision for revocation, which is what we mentioned. But
goody, back to finally getting to that.
So if you look at a certificate, it has a bunch of fields which say things like, what domain is this certificate for? Which private key was this signed for so that you can verify the certificate? When does it begin? When does it expire? And then there's another field which allows the specification of a URL to a validation server. That validation server runs something called the Online Certificate Status Protocol, or the OCSP, and it basically returns thumbs up or thumbs down. So if you get handed a cert, you can read out the URL that is verifying that cert and contact that URL and say, this serial number, is it good or bad? And it will say good or bad. And that's the simplest way we can check if a cert is good or bad. So the company issues, say VeriSign issue a cert. VeriSign's URL is in that signed cert, and it's signed, so it can't be changed. So your browser gets handed that cert. Your browser contacts VeriSign and say, you issue this cert, is it still good? And VeriSign will answer with yes or no. So that's good.
So that's something the browser companies can do. That's not us as humans.
No, we're not at the us as humans.
Oh, okay. Yet, I thought you said we were. Okay. All right.
No, that's where I said I went off script.
Oh.
That's next.
Okay.
But first, the technology.
Okay.
So that's one way of dealing with revocation. The other way is that certificate authorities can create a website where they simply list the serial numbers of all the certs they've revoked, and that's called a revocation list.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can use the OCSP, or they can use a revocation list, or they can do both, to specify all the certificates that have been revoked. And certificates get revoked for very mundane reasons. Let's say you're running a website and the website is hacked, and you're worried that the attackers now have the root certificate for your certificate. So the private part of your cert, the private key, which means that they could set up another web server somewhere and be you, which would be bad.
Okay.
So you then contact the person who signed your cert and you say, we've been hacked.
Please
our
revoke our
certificate. Our certificate has been compromised. Please revoke our certificate and issue us a new one.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So that's why this was built in, because the concept of a certificate going astray was always envisaged as being possible, which is why we have the city of revocation. So most modern browsers make at least some attempt to verify certificates. And I spent some time yesterday going through the settings on various browsers to see what they do. So Firefox always checks certs over the online certificate online certificate status protocol, OCSP, if there is one specified in the cert. And it's an optional field, so it's not always there. But if there is one, Firefox will check. Firefox also has the ability for you to specify certificate revocation lists.
As
There's
a human?
None in there by default.
As a human?
You as a human can go into the settings in Firefox. If you want to play along, you can.
Okay, I might not do that, but just good to know.
Go Firefox Preferences, Advanced Encryption, and then there's a button called Revocation Lists. And when you click on it, you get an empty list. But you can add to that list if you like. And in fact, Steve Gibson said that if you browse to the actual revocation list on Global Sign's website, Firefox will pop up and say, ooh, this is a revocation list. Would you like me to add it to the browser?
Oh.
So that's nice. So Firefox is fairly sensible. Chrome has a little checkbox that says, verify certificates, yes or no. It doesn't say which protocol it uses to do that verification. It's just a yes or no button. So I don't actually know how it does it. Maybe it uses OCSP, maybe it uses revocation lists, maybe it uses both. Maybe Google has a master revocation list that keeps on its server. I don't know what it does. It's just a checkbox. A little disappointing that we don't know more, but so be it. Safari doesn't have any form of UI whatsoever describing anything whatever to do with security around certificates at all. There is no control.
Okay.
Maybe they do really good stuff in the background, but they're certainly not showing it to us. So it's another reason I don't like Safari. They certainly don't allow us to specify our own revocation lists.
Hmm.
And I have no idea what IE does because I don't have a Windows machine. So someone else is going to have to check that out.
Okay.
So the caveats here are that specifying an online certificate status protocol URL is optional. So if you're a bad guy creating your own cert and then signing it with someone else's key, you're not really all that likely to stick in an OCSP URL. Doesn't really sound like a sensible thing to do if you're a bad guy.
Sure.
The other issue is that if a browser fails to contact the OCSP server, so let's say that they do some sort of denial of service attack and take down GlobalSign's OCSP server, browsers will fail open.
What's that mean?
So they will try to contact the OCSP server, and if they fail, they will assume the certificate is good. So they'll only reject the certificate if they can prove that it's bad. They assume it's good.
That seems backwards, doesn't it?
It's backwards from the point of view of security, but forwards from the point of view of usability.
Sure.
Which is, I guess, why it was done that way. And if a browser does use a revocation list and it fails to contact the revocation list, it will do exactly the same thing. It will fail open. So whether you use OCSP or revocation lists, if the browser fails to get an answer one way or the other, it will assume the certificate's fine. So although our browsers are taking good steps to check certificates,
it's still
there's
flawed.
A little maneuver there. So okay. This is where we get to take things into our own hands a little bit. One thing I should say about this fail open thing, if you're prepared to get dirty and go into about:config, which is a secret URL you can type into Firefox's address bar and it shows you all the hidden settings in Firefox, and trust me, there's a lot. You can go in there and you can change the default behavior from fail open to fail closed. And then you can manually add a whole bunch of revocation lists and then you'll be quite safe. But that's kind of everything. Right, that's not
okay.
Easy.
Are we going to get to real world people?
Yeah.
Okay, because I don't even think that's something you're going to do, right?
Yeah, I'm not going to do that. I could do that if I wanted, but no, I'm not.
And Firefox does say going into about:config can invalidate your warranty.
Well, you could just break things because whenever they're.
I know, but I like the way they said it. They said, like there is, it implies there is a warranty, right?
Yeah, I'm just going to say it's free software.
You can get your money back.
Okay, then. You can have your money back. I'll give you infinitely times your money back. Still nothing. Anyway, so you could do that, but really, who's going to? So if you had time and really good memory, what you actually could do was simply to watch the certificates that go through your browser, because they don't change very often. Firstly, you have to pay for them, so people don't change them on a whim. They tend to last for years. They don't last forever, but they do last for a few years. So why would you replace something that you've paid for with good money that lasts for a few years unless you had to?
Right.
So generally speaking, certificates don't change quickly. They don't change often. And if they do change, they tend to change by just being an updated version of themselves. So the same certificate authority, the same URL, the same domain, but just a
just
new...
Just means I paid my bill.
Yeah, just a new expiry date. So imagine like your credit card number owning a new expiry date. So if you were to actually watch them, generally speaking, when something bad happens, it'll be of the form of a certificate that you're really not expecting to expire suddenly expiring. Or a certificate suddenly changing CA unexpectedly.
How does one watch one's certificates?
If you wanted to, you can. If you're on an SSL page in Firefox, you can click on the lock icon and it will show you the certificate.
Okay.
So you could do this. But again, this would involve a lot of memory and thinking and stuff. Maybe if you only ever went to one secure website, you could do that. But I don't think that's realistic.
Okay.
So what we want is a plugin.
Ah.
A plugin that will simply watch certificates. So every time you go to a website that has SSL, what the plugin does is it stores what website am I on, what certificate is it using. And it just keeps a little database of all the certificates it sees. And every time you go to you go back to the secure website, it checks to see what it saw last time. And it says, okay, the last 10 times I've been here, I've seen this cert, and now I've just seen this cert. It doesn't expire until next March, and it's changed CA, and it pops up a warning and says, whoa, hey, for this reason and this reason, this cert's suspicious.
Hmm.
Very, except, very simple idea.
Except it's not going to work 5 minutes from now because Firefox is going to go to version 7. Because it's
well,
a
no.
plugin, right?
Okay, I mean, in fairness to Firefox... They've changed their plugin API, so from now on, as we're going forward, from Firefox 7 onwards, Firefox is going to... The version numbers of Firefox are going to be independent to the APIs for plugins.
Oh, so good, good. Well, I'm glad I asked about that, because that was driving you crazy.
It was driving me absolutely crazy. They're going for basically the Chrome-like model. Chrome races through numbers. Doesn't affect the plugins. Chrome's on like 13 or something. It was on 9 when I started using it less than a year ago.
And it's like 11 digits long, too, that I like.
Yeah, it's almost impossible to know what version Chrome's on. But it doesn't affect the plugins, and Firefox is moving to that model.
From 7 on. So once we get to 7, everything gets recertified, then you'll be okay.
Well, as I understand it, Firefox is not going to have a 7. They're simply removing all version numbers.
So
the number that will be visible internally within the product. So as a programmer, you'll know what version it is. But as a user, you won't. You'll just know you're using Firefox.
Well, how will you know if you're up to date, like what I just did?
Well, it will simply tell you there's an update for you, but it won't be telling you version numbers.
But it didn't tell me there was an update. I checked the version number, and you told me there was an update.
Yes, but it would have eventually, whenever we got around to checking.
Okay.
Whether it's checking once a week. I mean, I don't know what your settings are for how often it checks, but it'll behave like Chrome, is okay. The basic theory. Because Chrome's model works so much better. There can be, you know, Chrome has a plugin architecture, Chrome has plugins, and yet Chrome keeps itself patched, secure, changes version, no problem. So Chrome have proven it can be done on Firefox of saying, oh, okay, we can copy that. So again, it's like your Microsoft learning from Apple. The Firefox people finally seem to be learning from the Google people. So,
so
it's good.
Competition
anyway,
is good.
Competition is good. So the plugin is called Certificate Patrol, and it literally just tracks your certs. Depending on how curious you are about these things, you can change how talkative it is. By default, it puts up a little bar at the top the first time it comes to a site and says, by the way, I'm now tracking this site. And then it won't annoy you again unless something's wrong, in which case it'll put up a warning. But if you're curious as to what's going on, you can actually change checkboxes in its settings to make it really talkative and tell you everything it's doing. So if you're the nerdy, curious type who wants to know what's happening out there, you can do that. Or you can let it just be quiet and only tell you when there's something wrong, which is the default, and it's how I like it.
Yeah. This sure sounds like one of those things that I would turn on and then I would look at it and it would go, oh, it just said something. I don't understand it. And I'll click OK.
Well, that's the thing, right? If you install Certificate Patrol and if you're on open Wi-Fi, you're in Starbucks or something and you see a warning, you should stop and not do anything until you go home.
Hmm. How am I safer at home if it's a bad cert than if I'm at Starbucks?
Well, in order for someone to attack you with a bad cert, they have to be man in the middle.
Oh.
It's very easy to become a man in the middle in a Wi-Fi network, particularly an open Wi-Fi network. It's very easy to become a man in the middle in a hotel Ethernet network. But in your house, for someone to man in the middle you, they either need to attack your ISP's DNS server, which is always conceivable, but that tends
it's
to
sort
be
of two stopped. Things wrong at once.
Yeah. Or they need to be in your house.
But then how did the Iranians get in
okay,
wrecked
they
by
live
this?
In a nation where the government, where all the internet to Iran is funneled through the government.
Oh, we don't have one of those in regular countries?
It's not the normal way. If you even little places like Ireland have multiple points of entry into the country and the Irish government don't sit there filtering our traffic.
Oh, okay, okay.
It's like the Great Firewall of China, only it's in Iran.
How yes. sad is it that I just assumed my country did that?
With the Post-Patriot Act, it's possible they are.
Yeah.
They, you don't know what they've made AT&T do.
Right.
I don't want to go conspiracy theory here, but the law has weakened a bit in the States regarding that. But for most people, we can assume that the government are not actively trying to attack
okay.
us.
Okay.
So we're generally quite safe. So really, we're at most risk on other people's networks.
Actually,
so if you're out and about and you get this warning, that's a big deal. I would just close it up and do whatever I had to do when I got home.
We're at even more risk on iOS.
We can't even.
Can't even do a plug-in to tell you that you're at risk.
Yeah, and you just can't do anything. At the moment,
sure, you're not at a shared network, though. I mean, if you're on 3G, for example.
If you're on 3G, it's probably very hard to man in the middle you, so you're probably
right.
safe because it's hard to attack you rather than because your defenses are good.
Right, right.
But if you're on your iPhone on Wi-Fi in Starbucks, you're around about as dangerous as you could possibly
right.
be.
Right, 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 right.
So, anyway, Certificate Patrol, available for Firefox. I did some searching. I was not able to find anything similar for Chrome or Safari.
That's what I was going to ask. So... I'm hoping that what you're talking about here, running things like this Certificate Patrol, are a temporary situation that things are going to get improved in some way. Or is this forever? Would it be like this?
Not forever. I wouldn't say forever, because as we head towards the future, there are a couple of bright spots on the horizon. One of the reasons that we rely so very, very heavily on SSL is because we know DNS is really broken at the moment. So we know that we can't really trust the answer we get from DNS, particularly if we're on any sort of shared network. And so it's easy for a bad guy to send us to their server instead of to paypal.com or to our bank, because DNS is so easy to spoof. But DNS is moving, and it's a slow, plodding progress. But progress is happening. there are the DNS root servers are now signed. So DNSSEC is a new, basically a secured version of DNS, is out there and it is becoming slowly more and more adopted. Everything in the .gov domain is now DNSSEC.
Oh.
And that's going to slowly spread out as countries start to do it in their top-level domains, and eventually it will make its way to COM and .org. So, but that process has begun. There are now chunks of the internet that do have signed DNS.
Would you expect that to accelerate, or accelerate and then up to a point and then get to 90% and then the rest of everybody doesn't do anything about it?
No, the more that's done, the more quickly it'll move.
Okay. And so, who is it that does this conversion? I mean, it's not up to website owners to do it.
No, it's up to the people who manage
DNS.
It's up to the people who manage the top-level domains.
Okay.
So the American government were able to take care of .gov because .gov governments.
How about .com? That would be a good one to do.
.com would be the hardest one of all because it's A, it's huge, and B, it's very international. So what will happen next is I would imagine that you will find countries doing it. I believe Brazil have already done it. So .br, I believe, is also one of the top-level domains that's DNSSEC-enabled. And you'll find smaller countries like Ireland will have a much easier time of this. So I wouldn't be surprised if .ie were to join the ranks quite quickly. And then as the countries begin to do it, the pressure on the COM domain to do it too grows exponentially. So as more people do it, the weight piles on and eventually the whole system will become DNSSEC. And everyone agreed that that's where we have to go. So as DNSSEC becomes everywhere, then the pressure on SSL falls back a bit, because the likelihood of you being talking to the wrong person falls back. So these things will fall away. Then the other thing that you have happening is that I know for a fact that it's going to become harder to become a CA because the browser companies are scared. And they're going to start pushing forward things and being more strict and more tight and putting in more controls. And then you're going to have people like the EFF pushing in the other direction, monitoring it all. I wouldn't be at all surprised if the EFF come out with a certificate revocation list of their own.
Oh.
And that you would point your browser at the EFF's global certificate revocation
list. Instead of having to maintain it on its case-by-case
instead
basis.
Of pointing it at every single certificate authority, you could have a master list sitting on with the EFF or some other organization who could use the data from the EFF's observatory to spot rogue certs and add them automatically to the list. And so I think you're going to find lots of other ways to check it, because just looking for changes is a slightly indirect way of spotting problems. So I don't think it's a forever, but it's a really good stopgap while everyone panics and scrambles.
Is it 6 months?
I think we're talking 2 or 3 years, probably. A decade from now, I think it'll be much better. But 6 months from now, I don't think we'll notice any difference.
Oh, that's depressing, Bart. All right, well,
I know, but look at it this way. I mean, how long? It's what, a year or two since we had the very depressing talk about DNS is broken?
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm telling you that the entire .gov has already had the fix in place. When we were talking about it, they hadn't even decided between DNSSEC and some competing technologies. Since then, DNSSEC has won the race, the root certs have been signed, and top-level domains are coming on board. So, on the one hand, nothing happened in 6 months, but on the other hand, in the 2 or 3 years it's been, stuff has happened. So, expect the same speed of progress on this.
Okay. All right. Well, I still stand depressed, but I appreciate you explaining all this to us. And is there anything else you need to tell us before we cut us off?
I don't think so. If anyone has any questions, if I confused people on something, you know, send them in for next time and we'll try answer them, I guess.
All right.
It can be a confusing topic.
Definitely. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Bart. I appreciate all the information on this.
Yeah, my pleasure. Until next time, happy computing.
Well, that's going to wind us up for this week. Many thanks to our sponsors for helping to pay the bills, ScreenSteps from ScreenSteps.com and Smile from SmileSoftware.com. Don't forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com. Follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. I contribute a fair amount over on Google Plus nowadays, so just search for me by name there if you want to circle me up. It's really, really cool over there. Oh, and I haven't mentioned it lately, but I do still, I mean, they give everybody a gazillion invitations. So if somebody wants into Google Plus, just shoot me an email and I'll send you right in. If you want to join in the fun of the live show, and I really, really recommend it, the Nosilla Castaways have a lot of fun. Today we were, I don't know, talking about cat and dog names for some reason. They don't ever talk to me, but they're just having fun in there. Anyway, if you want to join in that fun, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time, and all the instructions are there. You can join in with the friendly and enthusiastic Nosilla Castaways. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.